You're listening to Reading Glasses, a show about book culture and literary life designed to help you read better. I'm author and book devourer Mallory O'Meara.
And I'm Bria Grant, filmmaker and e-reader. This episode, we're diving into how publishers choose the different fonts and margins in books with special guest Lauren Panapinto, creative director of Orbit, which is also one of Mallory's best friends. And y'all, we're dating into the nerdy shit in this episode, so get ready. Pull out your little glasses. Those are next to your reading glasses. There's the reading glasses, and then there's some nerd glasses right next to them. Because we're going to talk about fonts, margins, all the things that y'all want to talk about. Yes. It's going to be a great one.
And we took a bunch of listener questions for Lauren for this episode. So stay tuned for that. But first, what are you reading, Bria?
I'm reading Fuzz by Mary Roach, which, little known fact about me, it was very popular series on television, or I don't know if it was on television, but there was a When Animals Attack type series, and people would send me these videos because as long as the people didn't get hurt, if like a goose chases someone down, I was like, this is very funny. I just could not get over how funny it is to see someone like trying to dodge a bird or something, or you know, like, I don't know. It's just funny. This one is about when animals break the law and like what they do. And like there's a whole first part is about bears and how bears get into places they're not supposed to be in Colorado in people's kitchens. They'll just walk in and open a refrigerator. And definitely trigger warnings for people who if you're sensitive to animals getting killed for things like that or being put down. Then she also like goes to India and is like, oh, look at how differently they treat the animals here. But she doesn't demonize anyone, which I also appreciate. Or the animals. It's just like, here's what's happening. Here's how people are dealing with it in different cultures. But it's really great. What are you reading, Mallory?
I am reading another 2021 book that you read and that a bunch of our glassers liked. It's The Memory Theater by Karen Tidbeck.
This was almost on my top 10. Felt like it had been a while since I read it. And I feel like that unfortunately sometimes counts against books. I feel bad about that. But we both love this author.
Yes. Karen Tidbeck's amazing. They're just such a smart writer. And I guess this book is not what I expected, because after Amaka, which is a book that we both were fucking obsessed with, I was expecting something sci-fi. And this book is like very much a fantasy book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is about basically these characters that live in what we would call like the realm of fairy, you know, and they are trapped. They're human characters. One of them is sort of human. And they're sort of trapped in serving these like fae, like the fairy folk, all the fairy folk have just like basically gone mad, and all they do every day is just like throw these big weird parties, and these poor like trapped humans have to serve them, and then eventually the humans get eaten. This is not a spoiler. And so these two characters are like, well, this sucks, we got to get out of here. And it's about them like trying to figure out how to break open this fairy world and escape from there. And like I would actually say that if you love Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, you would love this book, because there is a traveling theater troupe that kind of moves between the worlds that is in this book. And it's so dreamy and so surreal, but really, really fun. If you're looking for a fantasy book that isn't like swords and sorcery, but is more, you know, again, like it's very much like Station 11. I think you will really, really like this. So that is The Memory Theater by Karen Tidbeck.
And mine is Fuzz by Mary Roach.
So we want to take a moment to share some listener feedback. Michelle wrote in about Christmas gifts. Hi, I just listened to your Christmas roundup and wanted to offer, as a fellow reader who often already has bought or borrowed from the library all the books that compel me to buy or borrow them, that my book list always contains books that I might like or which are recommended by a really trusted source but still haven't caught in my book buying gut. I love, love, love having a new book on Christmas to open and read. So this year, I'm going to share with my family a list of these books that keep making it to my want list but never seem to make it to really want. I'll be surprised and get a book I wouldn't have haven't anyway bought for myself. That is a good idea.
That is a great idea. I think telling people exactly what you want is always a good idea.
Yes.
I'm horrible at giving gifts, so I always appreciate it.
I love it when you ask someone what they want for Christmas and they just fucking tell you, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, 100%. So Jody wrote in and said, I just finished your episode on holiday gift ideas. One thing I like to ask for is the person getting me the gift for a copy of their favorite book. Oh, I like that. Best case scenario, I like it too. We can talk about it later. Worst case scenario, I don't like it and I just never mention it again.
Amazing. That is a really, really fun thing. I like that. That'd be a really fun thing to do with like at your work or for like a your book club or something. Just get everyone else. Everyone gets them, buys a copy of their favorite book and then swaps it.
I love that. That's great.
Pre-Staddy for everybody, for me. So Michelle wrote in, different Michelle. This is Michelle with two L's. First Michelle was Michelle with one L. Wrote in with a wheelhouse, which is memoirs featuring mental illness, palpable dark settings, slice of life literary fiction, non-World War II historical fiction, stories that involve crime.
Anti-World War II. Don't give me anything in the
40s. No dad books. Stories that involve crime, fiction or nonfiction, nonfiction about the human brain, mouthwatering descriptions of food, and this is very Bria. And nature writing that blows my mind and shows me how amazing our planet is. Fantastic. You can email us at readingglassespodcast@gmail.com if you want a list of all the books we talk about on the show delivered to your inbox every month. You can sign up for our newsletter. There's a link in the show notes. Some bookmarks from us. First off, folks, we are taking a week off from Christmas. There are 5 Thursdays in this month. So Maximum Fun always asks us if we want to take a week off, and we do. We've been working really hard this year. We've done a lot of stuff for the show, and we are taking a week off. We will be back the week after Christmas and the week before Christmas. The week before Christmas next week, we're doing our Best Books of the Year episode. So that's, you'll have 2 weeks to sit in it and read it and listen to it and check out those books. Also for me, I just want to say, folks, on December 14th, very close to when this episode comes out, I am doing a special event with the San Francisco Public Library, but not at the San Francisco Public Library, because the San Francisco Public Library rented out the champagne room at the Oasis Drag Bar in San Francisco. So I'm going to do a talk about girly drinks there at a drag bar. It is going to be absolutely fun. There are no tickets, so just show up at the bar. Again, it's in the champagne room. I'm really, really excited. So it's December 14th. The event starts at 7 p.m. I'm going to be signing books and giving away koozies and fun girly drink stuff. I'm really excited to do this. It's going to be a blast. We also want to remind folks, because a lot of folks are getting these as, giving these as gifts or getting them for themselves, that we have a link for Libro.fm gift memberships. If you go in the show notes and click on the Libro.fm link, we have a special link that... that we get paid if you get a Libro.fm membership and you get a free audiobook when you sign up for one. So everybody wins. We get to feed our animals. You get a free audiobook. We love working with Libro.fm, and we just think they're on our Bookish Gifts episode this year, because we think getting a Libro.fm membership for someone for Christmas is fantastic. Also, if you're listening to this, we're already in December and you're starting to panic because it's hard to get things shipped and you don't know what to get that bookish friend in your life. Libro.fm is great because you don't have to ship it. It's just something that happens electronically, can pop into your loved one's inbox Christmas morning or whenever you want to give it to them. It really makes a fantastic gift, and we have our own link for it. So check that out in the show notes. So before we talk to Lauren Panapinto about fonts and margins, we're going to take a quick break. Reading Glasses is sponsored in part this week by Storyworth. This holiday season, give your loved ones a gift that makes them feel special and unique, just like the relationship you share. Gift them Storyworth. Bria, we love Storyworth.
We really do. And if you're sitting there at home going, ooh, what am I going to get this person? I don't really know what to get them. And it's last minute. I don't know. Shipping is hard. Storyworth is perfect. You can go and sign up for it today. Because what is Storyworth? Mallory, tell people how Storyworth works.
So what it is every week, Storyworth emails your relative or friend a thought-provoking question of your choice, which is, that's one of my favorite parts, is you get to choose what they're getting asked from a vast pool of possible options, and each prompt asks questions you've never thought to ask. Like, you know, just things you don't normally talk about with your mom or your cousin or your grandma. What's the bravest thing you've ever done in your life? Or if you could see into the future, what would you want to find out? Jeremy and I got his mom Storyworth a few years ago, and Jeremy got to pick all the questions, and you can even write the questions if you want. And they were really, really cool. And then after, what happens is after one whole year, Storyworth compiles all those stories and from the questions that you asked, including photos that you pick, into a beautiful keepsake book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. It is such a cool gift. And Bria, I mean, you got one for your mom, and then your mom got one for her whole family.
She got one for her whole family. It was a really great gift, and it's awesome because you get to learn things about people that you haven't, that you may not have known. And it's nice because it doesn't matter where someone is, you can connect with them no matter how far apart you are. So with StoryWorth, you're giving a thoughtful personal gift from the heart and preserving their memories and stories for years to come. So go to StoryWorth.com/glasses to save $10 on your first purchase. That's StoryWorth.com/glasses to save $10 on that first purchase.
And remember, there's no shipping. This is a gift that can happen instantaneously. So if you, again, are panicking because you're trying to think of a gift for your grandmother or a family member that probably already has all the things that they need and you don't know what to get them, you don't want to ship something, you don't want to go to the post office because no one wants to go to the post office in December, this is something that you can do very quickly, and it is such a meaningful gift. It's storyworth.com/glasses. Glasses.
Glasses.
Well, Manolo, we have a show to promote. It's called Dr. Game Show.
It's a family-friendly podcast where listeners submit games and we play them with callers from around the world.
Oh, sounds good. New episodes happen every other Wednesday on MaximumFun.org.
It's a fast and loose oasis of absurd innocence and naivete.
Are you writing a poem?
No, and just saying things from my memory. And it's a nice break from reality. Are we allowed to say that?
I don't know. It sounds bad.
It comes with a 100% happiness guarantee.
It does not. Come for the games and stay for the chaos.
This week, we're talking about design work inside print books, fonts, font sizes, margins, line spacings. Who makes the decisions about all these details? I am extra excited to have Orbit Books creative director Lauren Panapinto here with us today to tell us all about it. Lauren, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh my God, my pleasure. I was just saying that, you know, I talk to you so much in real life. It's kind of like, I have to be careful that I don't just slip into normal talking about our day. Like, I have to put my professional head
yes.
on. Is this your professional voice? This is your professional voice?
I honestly, it's less about the voice and more about whenever I do a podcast or anything, like in publishing, you're working so far in advance. So I really have to think about what I can't say in yes. whatever given like interview or anything I'm doing. So now it's double because it's what I can't say because Orbit hasn't announced it yet. And what I can't say because of just, you know, like best friend stuff.
Yes. Yeah. That's the other thing. It's the most important thing is Lauren's my best friend. But before we get into the episode, I just want to let's brag a little bit and talk about the cool things that Lauren's done. We're recording with Lauren right now. Behind her, Lauren has worked on art and creatively directed the covers for The Expanse books, Nora K. Jemisin's books, the new illustrated Witcher book that's coming out, 10,000 Doors of January, a lot of favorite Glasser books. Lauren has made them look amazing and is in charge of those covers. Are there any covers that you want to brag about?
I just realized that I checked the calendar and I've been working at Orbit for 13 years now.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Which is insane, but also means, and for people that, you know, haven't, I think we did this like a while ago, but a creative director doesn't necessarily design every single cover, but we are in charge of making sure that all of the covers in our division or imprint, in my case, Orbit Books, are not only good, but kind of look and feel like Orbit Books should and things like that. So some things I designed directly. So like Nora Jemisin's books, I've always designed completely, you know, me designing the covers. But there's a lot of covers that either people on my team are designing, like Lisa Pompilio, who's fantastic, designed the Alex Harrow covers. And I'm kind of directing those, or a lot of times we use freelance artists and things like that. So, at this point, if you walk into like a science fiction and fantasy section of a bookstore, it's getting really creepy because I've touched in some way or been responsible for like a fifth to a quarter of the books in that whole
wow.
section. Now, it's really weird. It's like ghosts of, you know, book covers past.
Well, so speaking of books, before we get into things, gotta ask you the most important question. What are you reading?
Yes, and now it's my turn to brag. I know these aren't obviously aired on the same day they're recorded, but we're recording on Repeal Day.
Yes.
Which I thought was a great excuse to read. I have already read I've already read Girly Drinks in a few different, versions, because I was privileged enough to read Girly Drinks while Mallory was working on
it. Lauren is my first reader. Lauren gets to look at my books before anybody else does.
But I have the final copy, and then I hadn't read the final copy yet. So it's Repeal Day. So I started reading it this
morning. Lauren, thank you.
And it's fantastic. And for people that don't know, Repeal Day in the United States is liquor was illegal. Alcohol was illegal for a while. And then everybody realized, for many reasons, especially you will know if you read Girly Drinks, that it was a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. And it got repealed on December 5th.
Yay. Oh,
I will be drinking cocktails later.
I will also be drinking cocktails later. So we're really excited. This was actually a listener request episode, and I knew who else better to come on to talk about it. So walk us through this. We're talking about the cool design things inside books, not so much the covers, but the interior. It's the art department that makes those choices, right? It's not the editor, it's not the author.
Well, yes and no. I mean, what we're talking about, at least in my head, is both the interiors, so interior layouts, anything that goes inside the book, maps, chapter ornaments, fancy things you do with fonts, different sections, anything designy that goes inside. But also, we were talking, I know we have a bunch of questions about when you have a hardcover and you take the jacket off, that what we call that, undercover is a case. So the case has colors to it. It might be fabric or it might be paper, and it has foil stamping on it, all of those kind of things too. So all of that is, I would say, is under the purview of the art department to decide when it's kind of special or, when something extra is being done. So not every book, I think for every, and we're not talking about fancy special edition books, but for prose books, standard kind of books, whether they're paperback or hardcover, sometimes it's more of a team thing. So the editor might want something special on the inside, or the author might ask for something special on the inside. Or what happens most of the time, honestly, is the art department, in the process of doing the cover, says, oh, this ornament or this piece of the cover would look really cool as a chapter ornament. Let's give it to the interior designs department. So there's an interior design group, and in some publishers it's in-house, in some publishers it's out-of-house, but they're called compositors, and they take the all of the material. They take the manuscript, they take any bits that the art department gives them, maps, chapter ornaments, things like that, and they will lay out the inside of the book. Again, this is for prose books. For kids' books, it's much more hands-on. For picture books, for cookbooks, things like this. But we're talking about mostly like reading prose books. So we kind of give them all the bits and pieces, and in the case of a more special edition, I designed kind of the entire interior of the Witcher Illustrated, the Last Wish Illustrated that's coming out. So it's kind of up to the editor and author and art department to be like, hey, this could be cool. Can we do this? And then we just do.
So one of the things we get asked a lot, and we got a bunch of emails about this and listener questions, is so who's choosing those fonts, and how does the kind of the consensus come together of like how, what font we're going to use, and how, what the size of the font is? Is it, depending on how long the book is, like the longer the book, the smaller the font?
Yeah. You're always starting from every house has about two or three kind of base templates for what the interior looks like. And that will have been decided by, usually the publisher and the creative director, how big the margins are, how much space you like between lines, what fonts you like. I mean, there's basic scientific knowledge about what font sizes are comfortable to read legibly, what font sizes start to feel like a kid's book or a large print book or things like that. So we know kind of roughly. And then in style, serif fonts tend to be a little easier to read in text than sans serif fonts. I think if you've opened a book and you see like a sans serif font, serifs are the little feet on the ends of letters. So, Helvetica is a very well-known sans serif, lack of serif font. And they would be really weird if you read like a whole book in a sans serif font, you'd feel like it was like maybe a design book or a more modern book. So usually they're serif fonts. And then every house just kind of has a couple that they like, you know. We use a different one. We use different base fonts for our science fiction versus fantasy books. You know, it just gives a little subtle feel, a little bit of difference. But usually imprints or divisions have a couple of base templates, and then they'll change them up a little bit depending on what that editor asks for. What we really try to do is match, you know, kind of the, you know, not the base text font, but the chapter opener fonts, the title page, all of that stuff. We try to match the cover if the cover is done early enough that we can. If not, which happens a lot, because books are, you know, in process for a year or more before, you know, they're published. If we don't know, then, you know, I might say to interior, you know, the production editor is the one that kind of orchestrates all of this. So I might say to the production editor, we don't have the cover file yet, but we know it's going to be like a super fantasy kind of serif font. So, you know, use Jupiter or use Orpheus or, you know, I have about like 10,000 fonts in my head. I can't remember.
Oh my God.
Today, but like, I know fonts. You know.
That's some sort of, that's a weird superhero power to like, yeah. I'm font man.
Yeah. Well,
friends of mine like it, like when we're in restaurants, in a world where we were all sitting in restaurants a lot, and they'd be like, oh, what font is this menu? What font is this menu? I'd be like, I'd hang my head and I'd be like, you know, I don't know every font. Yeah.
But you know it.
That one is, yeah.
So Bria, question, speaking of fonts and sizes, as an e-reader, do you, I know you can set a preferred font and size. What do you set your Kindle to?
You know, I had to look this up because I'm just using the Kindle. Lauren, you'd be very disappointed. I use whatever was given to me. Whatever font was given to me, I looked it up. It's called Bookerly. Is that a real font? Is that something Kindle made up? I don't know. Is that a real font, Lauren?
I mean, if it exists, it's a real font, but okay. It's I'm sure it's proprietary to Kindle because I've never heard of it
before. Yeah, I never had heard of it before either. You can set it for different fonts. And I have moved up in the font size world recently because I have a little bit of trouble reading up close. I'm not quite at reading glasses level, but like when it's too small, it hurts my eyes. So I'm at a 7 right now, which is a specific thing on Kindle too. It has no, I don't think it has any correlation with like Kindle readers will be like, oh, 7. But I think it has no correlation with, you know, any other, the universal world of a font size. I
see. Well, strangely, even in print sizes, like a 10 point in Gotham is not going to be the same size as a 10 point in Bembo or a 10 point in Bedelia. Like that, it's wildly different, so it can screw with us quite a bit.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I actually got I don't know if they can do this on Kindle because I've never had a Kindle, but on the recommendation of a certain podcast called Reading Glasses, I bought a Kobo recently.
Yay
to read manuscripts and things. I was always reading on my phone and it was kind of
not great.
I am getting old. It's getting hard to read.
Phone reading is tough. Phone reading is tough.
Yeah. So I realized you could change the line spacing in between the lines, which is actually called leading, and L-E-A-D-I-N-G. And it's called leading, interestingly, graphic design nerd moment, because in the old days when we were setting metal type, like for newspapers or whatever, you'd actually have little strips of lead that you'd put in between the lines of text. So
wow.
The more lead you added, letting it had anyway, but on a Kobo and for most normal people, it's just called line spacing. And that really helps the legibility as well. So
yes.
You might not need a bigger font if you have more line spacing.
Yeah. I always gravitate towards books with nice fonts for sure, but bigger print. I've said on the show before that it makes me feel like I'm reading faster because I'm like, wow, look at, I'm just flying through these pages.
This page only took me.
Well, you mentioned it earlier, but the actual decision. So once we have those base templates, we can alter the size of the font, the space between the font, the you know, the margins, how much empty space is in there, and also the paper stock, which we haven't talked about yet, to make a book feel either bigger or smaller for a certain reason. Like you guys know in fantasy, everybody loves a honker.
Yes.
Or like a certain book. If you want a big epic world fantasy book to feel like a honker, sometimes they come in too big and we need to lessen the margins and lessen the spacing so that we make it a little smaller so it literally fits in paper, because you can only have so much paper in a trade paperback, say, before it rips itself apart, just under the force of its own gravity. And then, or vice versa, if we want a book to feel like more of a honker, we will give it a little more space. It's kind of like when you were writing term papers in college. And you
I will say, I always set my Kobo to a pretty big font, but with narrow, more narrow line spacing. That's, I just like it like that. And that's, I don't know if Kindle does it, but I do like being able to, because, you know, every ebook looks different. And if I make the font size really big, but then the line spacing is huge, I'm like, no, I feel like I'm reading a picture book right now. I have to make it more narrow. So Lauren, you mentioned earlier what a chapter, you said chapter ornaments. I don't know what that is. And I'm sure that some of our listeners don't. So let us clue us in here.
So sometimes there's art inside the book. Mm-hmm. So I work in fantasy sci-fi almost exclusively. So in the front of the book, you'll have generally when you start, there's like a blank page or whatever. And there's a copyright page and there's a title page. So the title page is usually what the cover font looks like, but it's just the title and the author name and usually the logo of the publisher. So like Orbit Books or whatnot. Sometimes there's half title pages if you really want to, like, you're really trying to add space or make it fancy, so that you'll see a page, you'll turn a page and it'll just be the title and author, and then you'll turn it again and it'll be the title, author, subtitle, logo, you know, whatever. And these are all holdovers from, you know, ye old ancient days of publishing. When every book was a collector's item. So you can have just a title page, you can have a title page and a half title page. But then, you know, in the front, if you have, say, a map or any kind of diagrams or stuff, that kind of goes in the front. And then, you know, if there's acknowledgement, whatever. But if there's art in between, like if there's chapter sections and there's a page that I was thinking recently, I think the last one we did was Once in Future Witches by Alex Harrow. Lisa designed entire pages for, because it's broken up into, I think, three or four parts. And then there's chapters within those parts. So for each part, there's a page that's completely designed in like cool Victorian type. We give those to the compositors to stick in. But a chapter ornament is, you know, when you turn the page and it's like chapter one, but if there's a little icon or something in there, sometimes it'll be, you know, I work in fantasy, so it'll be like a sword or a wand or something. If they're shifting point of view characters, a lot of times we'll make the point of view character have their own icon. So it's kind of this subtle viewer, like reader direction, like, oh, this is the sword guy. And later we'll have like the wand guy.
I desperately want to read a book about sword guy and wand guy becoming best friends. So before we talk more about book interior design choices, we're going to take a quick break. Reading Glasses is sponsored in part this week by my best friend, Soylent. Soylent is the original food tech company that makes delicious and nutritious nutrition products in convenient formats. I am obsessed with their complete meal shake. It's very convenient. It does come in a powder format, but you can also get the ready-to-drink shake, which I do. It's got 20 grams of plant-based protein, 39 essential nutrients, healthy fats, 400 calories of slower-burning carbs, and it means that I don't have to cook or clean and that I don't go hungry because I don't feel like cooking in the morning. But you like the squares.
I like the little squares because they are 100 calories. You can throw them in your bag. You can eat them at any time. Or if you just want a little special chocolate treat at any point in the day or after a meal. But you know what we never talk about? They also have an energy drink. It's not your typical energy drink. They have an energy drink that gives you energy. It has all these B vitamins in it. And it has a bunch of protein in it to keep. So it's not like you're drinking just like, you know, some other crappy energy drink. This one has protein in it. So it also, it's also like having a meal. It's like, it will make you full, which is awesome.
Yes. My boyfriend, Jeremy, likes the energy drinks. He has them in the morning before he writes. They're really fantastic. We love Soylent. It's the quickest, easiest meal on the planet. There's no cooking. There's no cleanup. And it's made from U.S. grown, sustainably sourced ingredients, which means that it's good for you and good for the planet. It is just healthy fast food, basically. No drive-through required. So you go to Soylent.com/glasses and use code glasses to get 20% off your first order. That's Soylent.com/glasses and code glasses to get 20% off your first order. Soylent.com/glasses. Glasses.
Look, it's a rough world out there, especially lately. I get it. So let's take care of our minds as best we can. I'm John Moe, host of Depresh Mode with John Moe. Every week, I talk with comedians, actors, writers, musicians, doctors, therapists, and everyday folks about the obstacles that our world and our brains throw in front of us. Depression, anxiety, traumatic stress, all those mental health challenges that are way more common and more treatable than you might think.
The first time I went to therapy, I was so ashamed, and I was like, I can't believe I gotta go into therapy. Like, I thought I could be a man, and Humphrey Bogart was never in therapy. And then my dad said, yeah, but he smoked a carton of cigarettes a day.
Give your mind a break, give yourself a break, and join me for Depresh Mode with John Moe.
Okay, all right. We are back with Lauren Panapinto of Orbit Books, giving us some insight about how books are designed between the covers. So Lauren, let's start talking about some cool, fancy stuff. So some books have started coming out printed with colored ink. That's something that you and I have talked about a bunch because first time I saw it, I immediately texted you and was like, look, this book is green. do you think more publishers are going to try stuff like that out?
Well, it's interesting. I think it really has a lot to do with how involved the kind of the art department is with the printing and the manufacturing folks in-house, because we deal with them very directly for the covers, but a lot of times the interiors are happening on a parallel track, you know, and we're not necessarily keeping track. It all comes down to kind of not just money, but availability of presses. So we've all been hearing about, supply chain issues and there being not enough book printers in the United States and things like that. A book interior prints on a one color press. So, there's a lot of presses that, you know, shoot out very quickly, one color, usually it's black, obviously, the default. You can change that one color to another color. You can make it, I know there was a book, I forget the name, but some Icelandic kind of book, but it happened in dark green.
Yes, that was the Museum of Wales You'll Never See. I was the one I was like, Lauren, look, it's green on the inside.
Yeah, no, it's super cool. So it's not any extra money to do change that one color, but it has to be a flat color. So it has to be one color out of the jar. You can't mix colors. So if you go up, then you end up on a four color press, and there's a lot less of those. So like anything with four colors inside, photos, things like that happen on a four color press. So it's very difficult to make a one color kind of prose book go on a four color press because it costs a lot more money. It takes a lot more time. The problem is also registering the type. So type always has to be in one flat color. Cause if you try to make it like CMYK on a, like in a four color press, it works, but like, you know, you get those ghosts. Have you ever seen like a misprinted page and there's like a misregistered? Happens a lot in magazines more than books. But there's like a ghost image. So you never want the entire interior of a book, you know, a prose book to have like a weird ghost registration issue. So I actually ran into that with The Last Wish Illustrated Edition. I wanted to make some sections of the text maroon because we printed the interior as two color. All of the interior illustrations and things are two color, red and black. So I was like, oh, and even me who's been in this industry so long, you know, I'm like, oh, well, we can make some text maroon. We can make some text red, some text black, and some text maroon, and that would be great. Mm-hmm. And then I realized in talking to the printer, they were like, well, we're not going to be able to register that close enough that we can guarantee that's not going to be a little ghosty. So you could do it on big text, you could do it on images, but you don't want to do it on the reading text because you want that to be super crisp. So it's kind of a press availability and money thing, but you can always swap out that one color to a different color. And I think you'll see more of that. But with supply chain and printer availability being a problem, you're not going to see a lot of usually one color books going to two color because that's a nightmare.
Well, so speaking of supply chain things, one of the questions that we had from the listeners, and because there's a lot of other cool stuff inside, there's fancy end papers and the foil stamping on the hardcover casing. Like what decides what books get those and not? Is it just like a money issue? Like why do some books get all the extras and some are just more plain?
I think there's always some things that are money things, you know, how much budget there is, you know, but it's funny. Some things are just choice and availability. So, you know, if you look at a hardcover, sometimes they're all one color. And I mean, the actual case, like the hardcover part of the inside of a hardcover under the jacket, whether that's one color or two colors, sometimes the spine is a different color than the body. That makes no difference in price. It's just different kinds of paper, whether you want it to be one color or two color. But people generally feel, and again, a lot of this stuff is subconscious. You're not like looking at a hardcover and being, oh, that spine is a different color. It feels more literary, you know? But it kind of is almost like, you know, elbow pads on a jacket, on like a professor's jacket, makes it feel more academic. So like the spine being a different color than the body, the front and back, has more of a literary feel. So sometimes you want that and sometimes you don't. Another thing that doesn't cost any money is just about people deciding is deckled edges. So when the edges
that was
are
another
rough.
Question because yeah. Deckled edges are a big they're a hot button issue in the reading community. I love deckled mm-hmm. edges. Some people hate
Me
them.
Too.
But I was really surprised. I didn't know. I remember Lauren, you telling me that it doesn't cost any. It's just like no, it's no money. You know, it's you just decide whether or not you get them.
Deckled edges is actually how books are made. Every book has a deckled edge until it's trimmed.
Right.
So if you just leave it deckled edge, then no, it doesn't cost any more money as opposed to trimming the book's pages together. There are some considerations though. If you have art on the inside, and again, this was something we ran into with the Alex Harrow, Once in Future Witches, is you can't have interior art bleed off the page and also have a deckled edge. So that can be a little strange because the decals go past the bleed area of the printing page. It's very... Well, we won't get the technical.
There are considerations.
But it doesn't actually cost any money. But again, we know as publishers that some people hate a deckled edge. Some people love a deckled edge. Same thing with French flaps. Like if you put...
Oh, I love a French flap, which sounds so dirty, but I love a French flap.
Yes, French flaps. I don't know why they're called French flaps. That would be a good question. But what a French flap is it's like... Jackets have flaps because they wrap around the hardcover. But if you do a flap on a trade paperback for some reason, it's called a French flap. And they usually paired up. If you have a French flap, you usually have deckled edges. But you can do deckled edges on paperbacks and not have a French flap. And Orbit's actually one of the only people that do that. We do that sometimes. We're like, because I had seen it together so prevalently or universally that I asked the printer once, I was like, do we have to have a French flap if we have deckled edges on a paperback? And they're like, no, it's fine.
It's funny that they go together.
So we've been hearing a lot about the supply chain issues. What, have you been affected by that? Does it mean everything's going to be written on, you know, leaves from now on? Can we not get paper? Like what's happening with that?
Yes, the supply chain is my entire life currently.
Is it? Is it a sore subject?
I think people aren't realizing too that supply chain is a big, gigantic issue. On one end, it's like, do we have enough paper? You know,
because that was another question is who chooses what paper gets printed on? Mm. Like why are books floppier than other books? Like what? So I'm assuming the supply chain issue is definitely affecting the kind of paper that you guys can use.
Yeah. When we did, and again, like books have standard paper stock. So like all of Hachette books, so all of the divisions and houses within Hachette all kind of use the same default paper stock. And our printers know that, you know, and it's probably most of the printers, like there's default paper stocks. There are ones you can do that are then. So there's a default, just like the interior design. And then if you need something special, you have to order it. So for certain, obviously like art books and cookbooks and stuff, they have a different kind of default stock. But like for The Witcher Illustrated, The Last Witch Illustrated, because there were illustrations and two colors of ink, we wanted to make sure that there was no show through on the paper. So we didn't want to have much thicker paper, but we wanted less show through. So there are papers that have less bleed through, and the paper ended up being a little brighter white so you could see the illustration better because regular paper is kind of a little off-white. But we had to make sure and get that order in way in advance. So that affects things. So supply chain is literally the supply of things. And there have been times that, stock in foils and things have been out and you have to pick different stuff and swap it in. And the reader wouldn't necessarily know that, you know, it was just a, the pool of options has been a little smaller and things. On the other side, again, the supply chain quote unquote issue is how much printers in the United States and outside the United States can physically print stuff. There's, you know, only so many printers, book printing happening in the country and in other countries. And the down to the second, scheduling of how long a book takes to print, how many print copies there are, how many books in a print run, things like that have been so scrutinized. And I mean, God bless my manufacturing folks at Hachette, because they're, you know, it's kind of almost, you know, those old movies of like how the stock market used to run, like in the old
everyone running around
yelling at each other. It's kind of what it's like. It's like, I got some book files over here. I'm ready to go. You know, the art departments are trying to get covers done earlier and earlier, and the interiors done earlier and earlier. So when there's an opening at a press, we can just jump in there. But things are moving. On sale dates are being shifted. And then on the other side, there's shipping issues. So, you know, like where getting stuff to the warehouse and out to the retailers is taking more time. So kind of at every stage of the process, it's a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah.
Ooh, but also it's what I think is being left out of a lot of these conversations is it's also a I'm not saying supply chain issues is a good problem to have, but during the pandemic, people have been buying more books, more print books than they have in a long time. So it's also a problem of quantity. It's not just that we're getting less of these things and there's less printing to be had. It's that we're trying to do more with less at the same time. So that's kind of why it's good news and bad.
Yeah, we like people buying more books. One of the big questions that that people have is how much all these cool things and how much control do authors have? And really is, I know as an author, it's the answer is it depends.
It depends. And we've talked, I think, on Reading Glasses before about it depends house to house how much, you know, direct contact between the art department and the authors there are, you know, and it's kind of a philosophy of that the publisher and the creative director and the house like, kind of all decide. So, you know, it depends. So if there's authors listening, you know, how much interaction you have directly with your art department depends. I tend to like to have a lot of direct interaction with my authors, but whether you have a lot of interaction with your art department directly or not, if there are things that you care about and you really want them, especially if they don't cost more money, like if you love deckled edges and you want every one of your books to have deckled edges, or you hate deckled edges and you don't want any of your books to have deckled edges, I mean, just talk to your editor. You know, like we absolutely always try to take author preference into account. Sometimes there are things that, you know, cost more money and we don't want to. It's not so much that a publisher doesn't want to spend money on your book. It's that, and again, this is a deep, you know, issue, you know, not issue, but this is just deeper than we have time for going into like how books are accounted for and everything. But in finance, but the more money is spent on your book package, the printing, the special effects, all that stuff, the more money it costs to make that book, the more time it's going to take for that book to earn past what it costs to make and then get money back to you as the author. So it's not always that, like, every book is accounted against itself. So, you know, it's not that the book isn't worth that. And I think that's what authors fear. Like, my book, is it worth foil, or my book, is it worth this or something like that? And that's not the issue at all. We're trying to guesstimate exactly what the best use of money on your book cover or interior, whatever it is going to be able to sell the most amount of books. You know, like it's a shifting sand, but what we're trying to do is, you know, make your book as attractive as possible to sell the most copies as possible, but not put an unfair burden on that book. You know, yeah. If I had a debut author and we piled, you know, just so much money in special effects, fancy papers, and printed end papers, all that stuff onto a book, it would be longer for that author to start making royalties. So, you know, it's not that your book isn't worth it or anything like that. It's just, it might not be the most economical use of bang for your buck.
Yeah.
We talk about that a lot. In art departments, like you can throw a ton of effects at something, but is it going to make a difference? Is that spot gloss going to make a difference for the design? Will this look that much better with foil on it? You don't want to just willy-nilly use effects for, you know, not a lot of, bang for your buck.
Yeah. No, I totally, so it seems like, a lot of this stuff is kind of like reverse engineered. So a lot of the interior stuff all stems from the genre of the book, the cover of the book. So it all matches how long the book is. So it seems like these choices happen after other choices are made about the book.
Yeah. A lot of things come directly from the beginning of the book too. Like editors will say to us, oh, well, there's, you know, like I said before, there's 5 point of view characters and we'd like a chapter icon for each one. So that's part of the concept of the book. Or whether a book has a map or not, honestly, has more to do with the author than anything else, especially in the fantasy space. Some authors have maps worked out and we're happy to have them re-illustrated and put them in there because readers love them. And some authors do not want a map in there, not that they don't care, but like either have a reason not to have a map in there or it's just not something that's important to them or they feel is important to the experience. So then we don't put a map in it. Things like that.
So a couple other questions. There's so many font questions. People are so obsessed with fonts. People are wondering if publishers own certain fonts. Cause I know we were talking about when we were prepping for this episode that my publisher, Hanover Square Press, definitely has one particular font that they use for like all their galleys. It was using Lady from the Black Lagoon. It was using a bunch of other things. Does Orbit or do most publishers have like a handful that that are like their go-tos?
Yeah. For interiors, for sure. And yes, to back up a bit, every fonts are licensed. So as opposed to a person just, you know, downloading fonts for free off the internet and using them for greeting cards or whatever, companies absolutely have to pay for and license fonts. And we are very careful that rogue fonts are not coming in from freelancers or things like that, because there have been many cases of font houses, and rightfully so, this is their hard work, going in and being like, well, you know, you guys didn't have a license for this font and you used it on X amount of books and you owe us X amount of money and retro. So we're very careful to, just like artwork, you have to license artwork to be on covers. And rightfully so, this is how artists make their money. You know, you pay for usage. So anyway, yes, there are absolutely fonts that publishers use and default to on the interiors, again, because it just makes everybody's life easier. You know, like an Orbit book will feel like an Orbit book, or like you said, a Hanover Square book will feel like a Hanover Square book. What's interesting so much as a designer is most people, even if they're thinking about these font questions, don't realize, if you're not a designer, you don't realize how much fonts work on you subconsciously. Like when you look at a font, and this is what I teach a lot in when I'm teaching book design to folks, the font you pick, absolutely, it's like the subliminal messaging of design. People usually, again, if you're not a professional, do not look at fonts and say, oh, this font is making me feel like this is retro. This font is making me feel like this is elegant. This font is making me feel literary or commercial or older or younger. But the second you see a font, it's priming your subliminal kind of subconscious. It's giving you a ton of messages about that book without you even consciously thinking about it. So that's the power of fonts. And again, those fonts that you use on the inside are not only about look and feel, they're also about legibility. They're also about, you know, it's so subtle, but the pointiness of a serif can make something feel more anxious, or can make something feel more comfortable, or, you know, it's so, so, so subtle. I could talk about this literally fonts. I mean, maybe we should just do a whole font episode. No,
people are extremely into fonts.
Yeah. And it's so subtle and it's so quick and it's so unconscious that fonts are really how we do most of our positioning, you know, especially in the genre world. There are fonts that are so obviously, like, they just say fantasy to people. You know, there are fonts that are so overused to a point, really. And I'm guilty of that too, because they just scream fantasy to people, even though if you saw them in the list, you wouldn't necessarily look at it and say, oh, that looks fantasy. But as soon as they see it on a cover, they're like, oh, that's a fantasy book, you know?
Gotcha. So final question. listeners were very excited about this.
I can talk about this stuff.
And often we do. I'm very spoiled as an author that my best friend knows all of this stuff and does all this stuff for a living. So someone wants to know, are there any interior design trends that are hot right now? Things that you're excited about? Anything like new and changing? It seems like something that a world that wouldn't change very much, but it's, I'm guessing that it does.
Well, yes. I think the trend is that there is more and more personalization, I would say. Not personalization, but like personalization per book or book individualization happening. And that has been a trend that has been happening since ebooks happened. So once ebooks started getting popular and the interior design of them kind of gets erased, you know, people can consume stories without buying a physical book. So why would they want to buy a physical book? They want to buy a physical book because, I mean, again, granted, aside, some people just like reading on ebook and some people like reading in print. But the reason, since ebooks are cheaper and easier, what the trend has been to make the print books more differentiated from that. So they're not generic. You know, they're not quickie. You know, they have more and more design in them to make them covetable as an object, you know, that you want to keep. So it's not a secret that mass market paperbacks declined greatly in the face of ebooks becoming more popular, because that was the quote unquote default or least expensive kind of least designed format. And again, there are certainly plenty of mass market paperbacks out there, but you could see if you go back in history and look at book sales, as ebooks rise, more and more books that would have been in mass market paperback go to trade paperback because it's a more collectible, long-term kind of format. And people feel nicer about, it feels more collectible, you know, things like that. So the trend interiorly is also to put more art inside, to do things like, you know, colored end papers when you can. The collectible market. So special editions, you look at things like Illumicrate, all those subscription boxes. And again, this is stuff that happens in genre, but it also happens in mainstream. Publishers like the Folio Society, things like that, these special editions of already loved books, popular books getting reissued over and over again, has really become a much bigger part of the market because people want to, you know, they could have the disposable version, you know, the ebook kind of version that lives virtually. But if they're going to buy the print version, they want the really nice print version. The difficulty for a front list designer, so somebody putting out new books as well as backlist, is people are willing to spend a lot of money for a very fancy edition of a book they already know they like. But you have to be careful not making a new book, so like a debut author or a first book in series or a new book coming out. You want to make it feel special and like an art object that somebody wants, but you don't want, again, to burden it with so many costs of production that people don't take a chance on it.
Yeah.
So balancing that, it's very easy to do a special edition of a backlist book. It's a little harder to make something, you know, feel special that's a frontlist. So again, you do things that are quote unquote costless. So adding art to the inside or, you know, things like that. If it's art that's already been done for the cover and you're just repeating it or using it more widely, is something that doesn't cost the publisher any more money. It just costs us a little work and we're happy to do it, you know? So I think you're going to see that happening more and more. I think authors, just people in general, are more aware of things like fonts and ornaments and things, and they're clamoring for that. So I think, you know, you'll see more and more of that. I think authors, the more that authors ask for that stuff at the front end or thinking about it while they're writing their book, you'll see more and more of that come through. I mean, I think we were talking about headbands at some point, and we didn't mention headbands here, but they crack me up because they're like the mock turtlenecks of book publishing. So what a headband is if you take a hardcover and you look at the top of it, like the top of the pages, like the actual top view, all the way at the binding end, there's a little strip of color. There's a little bit of fabric there, and it's called a headband. And in the old days of bookbinding, when we were bookbinding stuff by hand before mass producing, which I'm very intimate with because my senior portfolio for School of Visual Arts when I graduated was a hand-bound hardcover book. And it's very hard to do. If anybody has done hand binding, it's very exact and very intricate and very hard and wonderful when it works. Horrible when it doesn't. But anyway, so you need that strip of fabric. There's a whole strip of fabric against the entire, you know, block of pages to help hold that glue. That's what glues the book into a book, you know, kind of the pages into the hardcover of a book. But these days, like, glue is so much better, and the way things are held together, the most of the strength of most of what's holding the books into the hardcover case is the end papers and the glue there. So, you know, you don't really need a headband. So you could just get rid of it, but a book doesn't look like a book without it, even though you're kind of not noticing that it's there at all. Go look at your hardcover.
I notice mine, but again, like, you are my best friend. I feel like I notice more particular things.
So on a hardcover now, you'll see this, you'll see this little strip of color, and you'd think that because it's the same at the top and the bottom, you'd think that it goes all the way through. It does not. It goes like a quarter of an inch.
Oh, that's hilarious. It's just, so it's just like a weird little, or I guess a mock turtleneck is the best way to put it.
Yeah, exactly. It just like stops at your collarbone.
Like, you remember in the 2000s when everyone was doing that thing where they would wear like a lacy tank top underneath their shirts?
Yeah.
And then exactly, and then finally some people got wise to it and then just put a little triangle of lace into the into the shirts to look like there was a t-shirt or a tank top underneath. Oh, right. That's amazing.
And that's what I mean. That's a holdover from hand binding books that we don't really need. I mean, trade paperbacks don't have them.
Yeah.
You know,
but it makes it feel like a book.
It makes it feel like a book. So, but, you know, again, most authors don't think about this or care about this, but you can pick the color if you cared, you know, like if I get an email from an author and they were like, I really think it would be cool if all of my books through the whole series had the same color headband. I'd be like, awesome. It's so cool that you thought about that. I would be happy to do that for you. You know, I think it's just stuff that a lot of the stuff is options that authors don't
know to ask.
About, yeah.
Well, I hope if there's any authors listening that they now know that they can ask for cool things again. I do, because I have the knowledge thanks to you.
Oh my God, I just had a vision of all the creative directors in publishing yelling. Well, yeah, I mean, again, some things it's hard to know. There are many things that an art department or a publisher could do that are literally, you know, don't cost any money, but look like they might. So it's hard to know what would or wouldn't cost money. So, but I mean, again, it doesn't hurt to ask.
Exactly.
Like, if it's possible, you know, especially if it's something that deepens the reader experience,
like,
you know, icons. I have a lot of authors that ask for, you know, chapter icons or separations between parts. Can we do something here, you know, to make it feel like a different section? Or a lot of times there's books, again, this happens in fantasy a lot, that, you know, there's a book within a book.
Yeah.
So when you're reading the book within the book or pages of the book within the book, that page will be designed different. So it looks like a different book inside the book. You know, we do that.
So before we go, do you have any books that are coming out right now whose interiors you want to brag about a little bit, or anything cool things you guys are doing?
Oh my God. I've been at Orbit 13 years, but speaking to how much more demand there is for special editions, we've done more special editions this year, I think, than we have. Period. So I did a 10th anniversary edition of Leviathan Wakes, the first Expanse book. That's super fancy and had, like, if you see this book in the store, it screams at you because the page staining, the page edges, it's called, you know, color sprayed edges is what they're called. But the edges of the book are a color and they're bright magenta pages.
Yes. It's funny. I went into a Barnes & Noble when The Day Girly Drinks came out to sign books. And I remember texting you about this because the first book I saw when I walked in on one of the tables was the new fancy edition of Leviathan Wakes. And I was like, that's Lauren's book.
And that was really fun because it was a collaboration between a fan artist who had done these, like, very minimalist kind of posters for The Expanse, and we hired him to Jay Clark. We hired him to kind of, you know, work with those posters and make them into a cover. So I hope we keep doing more of those. I think it was very well received. But you know, foil the whole, because it's a special edition, so you can charge a little more money. You know, people want it, because they really like The Expanse. So you could make. We did colored ends. We printed the original art for the first Leviathan Wakes book by Daniel Dacciu on the inside jacket, so you could flip the jacket if you wanted to. We did so many cool things in that book. That was fun. And then the monster project was, again, I've mentioned a few times, the Last Wish Illustrated, which is the first, it's short stories, so whether it's not the first book in the series, but it the Witcher book that the first season of the Netflix show was kind of mostly based on. It's seven short stories, it wrapped inside like a holder kind of framework story. And we did a illustrated edition that had a different illustrator do an illustration for each story, and it's super fancy, and like the hardcover's great. And that one was fun because on the case, so under the jacket, we did a foil stamp on the front of the cover. Usually you just do it on the spine. It does cost more to put it on the front or the back, or, you know, foil other places. But we did a whole quote on the front cover, and I had never done that before. So when you take off the jacket, it's not another piece of art stamped in. It's a quote, and I won't give it away, but it's a fun one.
Very, very sexy.
Yeah, those were super fun. And I think if you're talking about the next kind of advancement in bookish technology, which I know you guys love, what we're doing is we have, so with Google, there's a program called Google Lens that's augmented reality.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If you look at a number of Orbit books, we've been doing kind of a class, like debut class every year, the last couple of years. So like the new authors of 2020, the new authors of 2021. And we do cover animations in augmented reality. So if you see the physical book, or it actually works on a picture of a book, if you're looking at a picture on the internet, but if you hold your phone up, and you have the Google app and you look through the camera in the Google app, it pops up a cover animation. And we've been doing that for a couple of years now, and they're really fun and people love them. And we've been doing author interviews on the back cover. So if you flip the book over, it's very cool. But for the very first time, we've done an augmented reality cover or illustration animation for every single illustration inside. So all
that
of
is
the full page.
So fucking cool.
Oh my God. It's so cool. And I don't know that anybody else has done that yet. So I'm very excited about that to hit. That's not on sale till, it's coming up December 14th, I think it's on sale, 15th, that week. So like 2 weeks from now, maybe exactly when this is airing, I'm not sure. Maybe it's already out, but we will be, follow Orbit Books, because we'll be posting a lot of videos of doing that in action. And it's so much fun, and the artists are so excited. It's very exciting.
Well, folks should be following, if you're listening to the show, you should be following Orbit Books anyways, because they are just crushing the cover world. Obviously, I'm very biased, but Orbit Books covers are just incredible. Lauren, thank you so much for waking up early on this, or I guess it's not so early for you, but getting up on Sunday morning to talk to us about this and answering all the Glasser questions. You are the best, as always.
It's my pleasure. And I was a little afraid, because I haven't been on in a while, that I was like the Snuffleupagus of reading Glasser.
You are the Snuffleupagus. Sean is the Wilson. You are the Snuffleupagus.
You mention me all the time, but I don't actually.
we need to have you come back on so everyone can. There's a few.
I am happy to come on anytime. I'm more than happy to do a whole font questions and answers.
Maybe we, honestly, after this, we might have to. thank you, Lauren.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Now let's solve a bookish problem from one of our listeners. Allison writes in, I love listening to your podcast because I feel it helps normalize talking about what you're reading in casual conversations. I find the more I do this in my own life, the easier it is to find my people. My dilemma has to do with reading fiction as part of a personal research project. Most of the time it's great, but if you're not enjoying the book, it starts to feel like homework. I'm really interested in the social and cultural history of 1920s Berlin, and I've started writing my own fiction within that setting. However, I'm finding a few of the novels written in that time period a real slog to get through. They feel like essential texts I have to read to understand my setting, and I struggle to reconcile that with my resolution to abandon books I'm not enjoying. But if I give up on it, I might miss out on historical details or important social themes. Have you encountered this dilemma, and do you have any tips on getting through unenjoyable fiction for the sake of knowledge, or is it even worth it? Thanks for the podcast and your help. My wheelhouse is obviously 1920s Berlin, mousy heroines with hidden darkness, mother-daughter immigration stories, Jewish-American identity, and characters trapped in bizarre existential prisons that they that have their own internal logic.
Cool. Wow.
Wheelhouse. Wow, what a specific... So
we
specific.
Love a specific wheelhouse
bizarre
on the show.
Bizarre existential prisons that have their own internal logic. Name, what is a book in that category?
I couldn't tell you.
Okay. Okay. Great.
Allison's going to have to write in and give us some recommendations.
Please do.
All right. So Bria, what do you think Allison should do?
So, I mean, I think Mallory and I can both safely say we have encountered this problem. Because we're often doing research. I'm often reading things just for research. Like especially there's always these books that people will be like, oh, you're writing about that thing. Have you read this? Because that's going to be, it's going to somehow dictate your world. You need to know what came before you. And I do totally believe in that, that you should sort of know the world you're entering into, to an extent. I mean, I think probably Mallory has a different take on this because I often am doing creative stuff, which I think Allison is doing too, not nonfiction. I'm doing narrative stuff. So I try not to read. Sometimes I stay away from stuff specifically because I'm worried it'll like tell me too much and I'll end up like copying things by accident. But anyway, so I'll say this. First of all, take to heart, if something is boring,
dump it.
It's good to know. No, I'm saying it's good to know because then you should know that you shouldn't write something like that.
Oh,
so it's
you know
boring,
what? Yeah, that's a good idea. It's good to know what like, the boring things are.
No, it's good to know and to call out what is boring. I will say for me, I do try to give things a shot. I'll read a chapter or two. But if it's so boring that I'm like, ugh, this is a slog and like it's not really going to make that big of a difference, I'm going to just find a synopsis on the internet and move on. Because if these are important books and they have important themes, someone has already, some grad student somewhere has written a paper on them that you can go read. Now, is that going to be
God
boring?
God bless maybe. Grad students.
These papers might, but it may be boring. You may end up reading nonfiction that is also boring. So I know we always tell you to dump it, and I think it's probably different depending on what you're doing, but I would say find the information you need to feel like you feel secure in your work. But I guarantee you, as a person who, like, your wheelhouse is already these things, you kind of already probably know the themes and the historical moments, like these details that you're talking about. Like, I think you probably, I think Allison already knows these, don't you? Allison's already done the work and looked into these. And I'm going to do a real hard pivot here. And say, first of all, we want you to not write a boring book. So like, don't, you don't have to read all these boring books, but no. Because I don't want you to write a book like that. I want you to take the things you know, read the stuff about that time period that you think will be relevant to what you're writing and move on because, and I don't want to call you out here, Allison, but sometimes we're all doing research in order to distract ourselves from the work we need to be doing. And is this maybe the case? Could it be that you already know all these themes? You already know the historical stuff. And if you don't, go find stuff about that. Go do that research. Read the Wikipedia page. Do whatever you need to do to find out this specific information. But I think at the end of the day, you need to get on with your creative work and don't let things stop you because you can sit here and slog through this book or you can start on your creative project and find information about that book in a much easier way. So I guess if we're giving a specific, I'm going to say to try these books. I think you should try if you feel like they are relevant to your work, but I would not spend so much time getting bogged down in them because you can really spend a long time trying to read a boring ass book when you should be writing your own really great book if that is the goal. Because I think Allison already has all this information and probably knows it. Don't you think? If this is like Allison's wheelhouse, I think that Allison probably already knows these historical themes that she's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I'd argue, again, I'm obviously a nonfiction writer, so I'm coming at it from a different angle, but I just don't think she needs to read I mean, it, maybe one or two, but I don't think she needs to read them en masse. You know, no. You can get, you can give them a quick browse to check them out. But if you're going to get more knowledge, obviously, from nonfiction on the subject, you should, I just think Allison shouldn't be reading fiction books to get knowledge about this time period. Even narrative nonfiction will help her out more. I mean, novelists take liberties. So Allison can't be sure that the knowledge that she's getting from these books is real, is accurate. It might just be something that the author did for this particular book.
I assume she's reading books from this time. Is that what she said?
No, she's like about during
just about
this time.
The time. Just about the time. So novels written. No, she says, I'm finding a few novels in that time period. So she's reading ones from the 1920s.
Yeah, but even then, like, sure. It's still not, you can't be sure that the writers are writing depicting things accurately. If you're looking for information and you get bored, watch a documentary about that time period. Even watch a feature film, because that will give you watching a film can help you get sort of like the ambiance, the sort of texture of things a little bit better. Some of the, you know, that historical flavor. I just don't think you need to read unless, you know, maybe if one of the characters in Allison's book that she's writing is reading this particular book. Obviously, mm-hmm. You have to read that. But other than that, I just don't think, I think we're both in agreement that Allison does not need to read that many of these books. I think you said a great thing. If you can find a Wikipedia article or a summary about what's going on in these books, but you don't have to read all of them, especially if you're trying to get knowledge.
And there's probably some really great like micro histories about this time period, about whatever historical thing. Again, some grad student in American studies wrote a paper about, you know, the chairs they're sitting in or something. And so you can always find these things without reading the books that I think I agree with Mallory. It's probably going to inform you a bit more unless you love these books. And then I'd say read them. But we're not telling you not to do the work. I'm just saying that sometimes the work can look a little bit different.
Yeah, I just think, again, I'm a stickler for this because I'm a historian. I'm a nonfiction author. You're not if you're looking for accurate information about the time. I mean, that would be, think about it as if someone wanted to find out about what was going on in 2021 and was reading novels that came out this year about this time period. You would get a little bit, but it's nothing compared to a nonfiction book that you're going to get when it comes to knowledge. Or, you know, one book might help you kind of get the way that some a character might have felt about living in that time period, which is something that's harder to get. But if you're looking for straight up information about what people were wearing, how much things cost, what people did, you know, like I'm trying to think of a book that came out this year.
Year.
Yeah.
The Sentence.
There you go.
That book is all about things that happened in the past year. And it does cover like so much about the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement and things like that. But it also has a ghost in it. So like,
yeah,
I just
that's
don't
what
know.
I mean. It's not. It's just not. It's not going to. It's. I don't think that. I think Allison is doing extra work that is not. She's working hard, but. Not necessarily. Maybe the hard work is not going as far as she wants it to.
Yeah, Allison,
she's expending energy for no reason.
Mallory and I are saying we want to read your book. We would like to read your book.
Do.
So, like, write that book. Go write it. And I know that's hard to do, but I think go write it. And if you don't feel like you know some of this stuff, like Mallory said, like you know, watch a documentary, read a paper about it, read the Wikipedia page about it. It's going to give you a lot of information. People have done research on these books if they are these essential texts. Has been work done on them for sure.
Absolutely. So if you want us to solve your reader problem, or in this case, your writer problem, send it to readingglassespodcast@gmail.com. As always, we want to thank the wonderful mods who run our Facebook group and Chrissy and Rachel who moderate our Goodreads page. Remember, we have that sweet ass store, our new Void merch store. We love it so much. You can get shirts and totes and stickers to laminate and turn into bookmarks. We just love the store so much. We wear our stuff from it all the time. There's a link in the show notes for that. And if you like the show, please rate and review us on iTunes and Apple Podcasts, other places. I don't think you can review on Spotify, but there are many other places that we are that you can review. It really is great for us. It helps us reach more readers and reach more advertisers and seem impressive. And like people are always like, oh, so many reviews. Got to check this place out. Got to check this podcast out. If you want to email us, you can go to readingglassespodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter at Reading G Podcast, on Instagram at Reading Glasses Podcast. Thanks for listening and thanks for reading.
Thanks for reading.